Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We live at a time of many challenges. Women are needing to defend rights we thought we'd won a generation ago. The power of fossil fuel companies is blocking vital action on our climate crisis. And many Americans are concerned about power grabs by an autocratic president who yearns to be a dictator. The challenges can seem overwhelming. Yet it is entirely possible that this time of crisis could be a rebirth of our democracy. How do we win? Our guest today just wrote a book answering exactly that question. George Lakey, professor at Swarthmore College and lifelong activist for peace and human rights, just published a new book titled How We Win. It's a guide for achieving real progressive change, written for protesters and community builders. He is also the author of Viking Economics, How the Scandinavians Got It Right and We Can Too, which we discuss with him on this program in October. George Lakey, welcome back to All Together Now.
It's delightful to be back. Thank you.
Wonderful. I was so excited to get your new book, and just invite you to tell our listeners what inspired you to write this new book, How We Win.
There be becoming so much activity in this country the last few years. We think back to the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement and the teenagers in Florida, and just on so many fronts, climate activists moving to a new level. There's so much going on that really, teacher strikes and so on. There's so much going on. And it was at such a time, 50 years ago, that a friend of mine and I, who were in graduate school at the time, realized that, that 50 years ago being during the Civil Rights Movement, realized that a time when so many newbies come into the movement and people in the movement, you know, heighten their own level of activity, that that is a great time to put out a manual that shows what the best practices are. So we don't need to be inefficient. You know, we can learn from what works and just make as few mistakes. We'll make mistakes, but, you know, not having to make all the same mistakes. We can make our new mistakes and also proceed in a much more effective way if we have a manual to accompany us and carry with us to the demonstrations. So that's why I wrote this book, because it's time for, I mean, that was 50 years ago. This is for today.
Well, it's very timely. And so we want to right off the bat answer the question, how do we win? And you talk in the book that the key to winning is to build nonviolent direct action campaigns. Can you describe what exactly that is for people who may not have heard of it?
Sure. A campaign is when you choose something that you care about changing. You feel it very strongly, and you also realize that it's something that is available, maybe not in the next year, but that if you really put your mind and heart to it and got lots of friends on your side and then got more and more people on your side, you could conceivably win it. So it's choosing a goal. That's one characteristic of a campaign, a very specific thing. Well, what's an example would be women fighting 100 years ago for the right to vote. That was a very specific thing, and they went for it. And then another thing about a campaign is that you expect to win somebody over. You expect to get somebody to yield to you what it is you want. So, for example, the women's suffrage movement realized that if they got the president at the time, who was President Woodrow Wilson, to turn around and be on their side, that that could then change the national scene, especially Congress, but also the states. And so one thing you need for a campaign is to know what you want in very specific terms. And then another thing you need is to identify who can be the decider that can make the difference for you. And then you need also to realize that you're going to do a series of actions, a series, in fact, of escalating actions. So it's not just a question of a one-off expression of opinion. Most power holders look at you when you're doing a one-off, you know, a day of expression of opinion. Oh, well, that's their opinion, so what? I can continue to do what I want to do. But when the power holders see a campaign, which is a series of actions that keep pressing them, then they realize, uh-oh, now I have to take seriously, am I going to give these folks what they're demanding?
Right, exactly. Well, you mentioned about Alice Paul, about the women's suffrage movement and how they followed this whole idea that you're talking about, nonviolent direct action over time escalating to an impact, and that, you know, women had wanted the right to vote and worked for it for something like 80 years, but it was when Alice Paul actually systematically designed and executed a whole nonviolent direct action campaign that women actually got the right to vote in 1920. You mention in the book that you actually interviewed Alice Paul, and she is a hero of mine. I'm wondering what you felt, what she was like, and what did you personally learn from her?
Oh, it was such a privilege to get a chance to have some time with her. I was in grad school, and it was going to be a paper, you know, which ended up being published, partly because she was willing to be interviewed. And so I was particularly interested in knowing what she thought of the contemporary movements that were going on at that time. This was in mm-hmm. the '60s. And she said that they could be way sharper than they often were. That is, that there was so much emphasis on being moral, and of course the women's struggle was very much a moral movement, right? But she said mm-hmm. there was so much emphasis on morality that she saw around her, and not enough emphasis on what's the concrete demand, what's the specific thing that you really want. And she said that was the big advantage, one of the big advantages of the women's suffrage movement. They knew specifically, we want the right to vote. It mm-hmm. was yes or no. And it was the very specificity. And then another thing that she emphasized was that she used a time of crisis to her advantage. This is really different from what most of us tend to think right now, because this is a kind of time when you wake up every day to a new crisis, it seems like, right? There's mm-hmm. just all this right. stuff going on. And it's very tempting to think, oh, well, in a situation of great crisis and dilemmas and so on, then how can we get our cause even recognized? But she turned up the heat of the women's suffrage movement during the First World War. And that was a huge thing that had been going on for years before the U.S. entered. It was going to be a tremendous bloodletting for the U.S. It had already been a bloodletting for the European countries. And President Woodrow Wilson wanted everybody to focus on the war effort, and many people were. And she said, okay, this is exactly the time for us to escalate our demand. And some people were saying, oh, no. I mean, in fact, the NAACP pulled back at the time from its civil rights activity, and the labor movement, some of it, pulled back a little bit. There were various groups, you know, that were saying, well, this is not the best time for us. And she was saying, no. If you frame it correctly, this is exactly the right time. So what she did was figured out a framing. She said, look, President Wilson, if you think it's so important to fight for democracy in Europe, then how about some more democracy right here?
Right. That's amazing. Well, we certainly have a crisis now, so let's use this time a crisis to our advantage and make the changes that we need. I truly believe that that's possible, and I'm actually really excited to be alive at this time. And by the way, hats off to Alice Paul and her allies in the women's suffrage movement when they clarified their specific demand, you know, beyond women's equality, yes, but the specific demand of the right to vote. They strategically chose it because once women would get the right to vote, they felt they could impact every other issue that elected officials were voting on, you know, tax and budget or environment or families or whatever it was. Once they got the right to vote, they'd have political power to impact every other issue. And that was so smart because it's been actually quite true. So good for them for doing that. Now, you also mentioned about the one-off protests that are happening. And we've had some just amazing ones with the Women's March starting right when Trump was inaugurated, with millions of women marching the street and men supporting them, engaging with them. But you are not enthusiastic about these kind of one-day marches. Explain why and what you think is a more effective way to take action.
The one-day marches can be inspiring in a way, and certainly, for example, that women's march the day after the inauguration of Trump, I was in San Francisco on book tour, and there I was with 100,000 people, and it was a glorious day in many ways, a celebration, and yes, we're together and so on, but I also was participating knowing that it wasn't going to change anything, because one-day events don't change anything. I mean, they can inspire people to do later on, for example, to run for office or something. But in terms of the actual impact on some decider, the deciders are watching the one-day demonstration. It doesn't matter how big. I mean, it's like, what was it, 4 million people or something
right.
that were on the streets of America.
Mm-hmm.
Unprecedented. I mean, that's a historical high. Okay, 4 million people out there. But the power holders knew perfectly well that at the end of the day, we were all going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to continue doing whatever they were doing. So that's the downside with the one-off. That's why the one-offs are not powerful, except as inspirational, or message kinds of things. But they're not really powerful in terms of delivering the goods. And that's a campaign, therefore, has it all over a one-day event. And when I sometimes think of the amount of energy that sometimes goes into these one-day events, sometimes people organize for months, and
mm-hmm.
There's big turnout and so on, and then there's bound to be a certain amount of disillusionment when we realize, wait a minute, nothing changed. And there's a good reason for that, that it simply isn't an effective or powerful means of change. And comparing it with, if you put that same amount of energy and that same number of people involved in an escalating campaign like Alice Paul did, then you can get something that has a really almost revolutionary consequences. In fact, we have in our database that we created at Swarthmore College examples in which a campaign actually overthrew military dictatorships. Nonviolent direct action campaigns can actually do that, overthrow military dictatorship, but a one-day event, no, it's not possible.
Well, that's really interesting to me. I hear what you're saying, and at the same time, I look at something like the classic March on Washington with Dr. Martin Luther King, which was a one-day event. But you're saying that was effective mostly because it was part of really a multi-year ongoing nonviolent direct action campaign. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And they were driving toward a very specific thing. In their case, it was the Equal Accommodations Act that they were going after, because there had been, you remember, 1960, the big wave of sit-ins for lunch counter sit-ins and that kind of thing. And then year after year following that, there were the swim-ins, you know, and people entering theaters and demanding to be seated on the first floor. And all kinds of things going on, libraries, black people going to white people's libraries and all that. Mm-hmm. Insisting on the anti-discrimination, and all that was building up to 63, the big march on Washington that you refer to. So it was all perceived by the power holders as this growing and escalating campaign that was was coming to a head, actually. And Dr. King then went back to Birmingham, Alabama, and that's where the rubber really hit the road with the dislocation of what was then a major industrial city and forcing John Kennedy, against his will, to back a civil rights bill that would actually, allow for the end of discrimination. So the end of legal discrimination. So, yeah, so the reason why the 63 March was so powerful was it was in that sequence of events.
Mm-hmm.
It was all driving toward a very specific goal, which is you can't any longer say we can't do something because of the color of our skin.
Right. Well, that's interesting. It's a great contrast you're drawing there, and I'm wondering, we've got some people participated or helped organize the women's marches. If you were talking to those women and advise them, say, you know, we love your spirit, we love your dedication, it's critical for women to be out now in the forefront, both for women's rights and for our country more generally, what would you advise them to do? Like, what specific demand do you think the women should be going for, and you know, what would a escalating campaign be for the women who are really concerned about what's happening and want to keep pressing forward for equality?
Well, a very tempting one that would not, I think, be that hard to win would be that would be very much in the interest of women, specifically women fighting for, would be leave with pregnancy leave and maternity leave.
Mm-hmm. Because paid family leave.
Maternity leave, because that's been so widely accepted in Europe, practically everybody does. I mean, we're this very, very stodgy country lurking very far behind the pack. And it would be focusing a lot on a value that's widely shared, which is the value of motherhood, the value of taking good care of children, the value of taking care of babies, giving babies a good start, and so on. So you wouldn't have any politicians arguing, oh, no, we don't believe in babies taking care of well, right? So
you'd really be
occupying the moral high ground. But the thing is, there would be very strenuous opposition to it from the part of the industrial and commercial interests who don't want to allow maternity leave. So it would be a very interesting fight, and I think it wouldn't be a very hard one to win.
That's
but it
fascinating.
Would take a campaign.
Yeah. That's very fascinating. And I think it's a one thing, you know, a lot of women want all, you know, we want everything all at once. But if we can win something like the paid family leave, then once you get that, you can move on to the next, right, which the gay rights movement, I think, has been brilliant at doing. And I want to invite you to talk a little bit about how you see this approach of nonviolent direct action campaigns has been so helpful as a framework for gay rights making such incredible progress, particularly in the past 20 years. How has that been done?
It's been done in the way that you suggest, choosing a specific thing and really going for it. In the, I was really struck by the retreat by many movements when Ronald Reagan became president in 1981, because his job was to try to push back on the, you know, increasing demands for progressive change in the 60s and 70s. And there were more and more victories being won in the 60s and 70s. You remember the women's movement, the environmental movement, and so on. And so it was Reagan's job to push back and even to turn back the clock and take reproductive rights away from women and so on. So all of that was going on, and what most of the popular movements did in those days was to go on the defensive and try to hold on to the previously achieved gains. So the women's movement tried to hold on to reproductive rights, and the labor movement tried to hold on to labor rights, and the civil rights movement tried to hold on to voting rights, and so on. Well, all of those efforts to hold on have failed because all those major movements have lost ground since the pushback began in the 1980s. But with the startling exception of LGBT folks who decided, instead of going on the defensive, which actually any military general would tell you, do not go on the defensive. And for that, and my guy, I'm more impressed by Gandhi than I am by the military strategist, but Gandhi said the same thing. He said, never go on the defensive, always go on the offensive. And so that's what the LGBT people did, and I was a part of that struggle very much. I came out as a gay man very, very early and took a beating for that and so on. But our goal was to go after one specific thing at a time. So during the Reagan period, that was to change the medical attitude and the government's attitude toward AIDS. And we succeeded in doing that. We made a huge change. It took a tremendous nonviolent fight on that. And then to go after marriage equality, I remember at the time some people saying, some of the homophobic bigots saying, well, we suspect a homosexual agenda, as if this was a sinister thing. And my response was, yes, yes, the homosexual agenda is equality. Equality, have you heard of equality?
Right.
And so we went after equality with regard to marriage rights, and we went after equality with regard to armed services treatment. Now it's about bathrooms. It's been setting goals, not trying to hang on to previous, you know, let's say in your city you got a human relations commission that was willing to go to bat for gay people. Not just trying to hold on to that. No, 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 no. It's a matter of setting a new goal and going for that like crazy, and that's the way to move things forward, and that's what's really worked for the LGBT folks. And I don't understand why the other movements that saw us making advances while they were losing ground didn't get a clue that
right.
strategically, well, the generals are right. You know, go for what you want.
Right. Well, I see what you're saying, but I think I can tell you why other movements haven't done it. And I'm thinking of it in relation to your wonderful advice for the women's movement to focus on a target, and probably paid family leave would be at the top of the list, because the movement's so broad and so diverse that everybody has their thing. I mean, there's some women who say, well, reproductive rights should be first, because if we don't have that, you know, we're not going to have the freedom to do other things. And other people go, well, it's pay equity. Unless women get economic power, we're not going to be respected or have the ability to be engaged in civic enterprise the way we'd like to be. So, you know, different people would say different. There'd be a big fight about, well, what should be the next top priority. So I think that would be kind of a very hard one. I'm trying to imagine how would we get all the people involved, or even a vast majority of the people involved in the Women's March, to rally behind paid family leave as a specific target. What do you think of that?
Well, this is an area where we can learn from the civil rights movement, because the civil rights movement, by and large, didn't try to get everybody on board a specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
They basically said, building the power of the grassroots is primary. So if in your city what really matters most is equal accommodations, go for it. But in this city over here, let's say Chicago didn't have a problem about equal accommodations. Chicago had a problem about voting.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a lot of discrimination and corruption going on about voting. So in your city, go for that. Or if voting isn't an issue in your city, but in yours it's a more of a housing issue, then go for that. So one of the cool things about a grassroots approach to launching a campaign and attracting the allies that you attract, but not trying to get consensus, is that it's a way of interacting with history such that we learn which are the things that are ready now. It's almost like going out apple picking and picking the apples that are really ripe right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying this and trying that and trying the other thing, trying 5, 6, 7, 8 things at once in different places, and then seeing what can be gone for, you know, that looks like, mm-hmm. whoa, that's the one that's really, really gaining momentum. And then having a networking relationship among all those different ones so that people can say, oh, well, now it's that issue. It's reproductive rights. It really seems to be a humdinger. Let's all zoom over to that one and get that one over the top, and then go back to this other thing that we've been doing, and vice versa. So that was a brilliant strategy that was pioneered by Bayard Rustin, who influenced me a lot. He was a mentor of Dr. King's. And he said, no, let's have a network of relationships where we can all pile on a particular issue when that looks like it needs it and it will be, you know, the critical moment for it. But knowing that then others will, you know, others will zoom over to your issue when your issue is at that place where it's kind of coming to a head. And it makes a very organic, almost like an ecological way of looking at change. So it's not just my cause, no, my cause, no, my cause. It's a much more collaborative way of working that that retains a certain amount of humility with regard to, well, we don't really know at any given moment what history is ready to provide, you know, where the breakthroughs really are. So let's try multiple things and support each other and see what we can do.
Yeah, I like that very much. And you write in the book about kind of that aspect in the civil rights movement where different localities would focus on something, like in Montgomery it was, you know, the bus boycott.
That's right.
And different places to different things. And then they were loosely connected with a network, but when a locality would do what it could do, and then it reached a point where it needed some national support, you could bring in some strategy, some resources. You might bring in Dr. King himself to speak at a rally or a march. You know, so it seemed to be a brilliant design with maximum flexibility, and it really dealt well with this, what can sometimes be a big tension between local action and then the national movement. So I love that whole model. It's really great. I think we need that model now, not only with the women's movement, but also with our democracy movement. I was just in Nashville a couple of weeks ago at an Unrig the System conference with people from across the political spectrum, all concerned about the state of democracy. So over 12,000 citizens there, and most of them taking action in their localities to try and, you know, one stopping gerrymandering the district lines, and, you know, just so many different things. And that's kind of an issue now in this, like, explosion of citizens working for democracy, is this tension between what's happening locally and then how do we support and engage and, you know, with some guidance maybe nationally. So I think the civil rights you're talking about is a fantastic model for that.
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic about that.
Yeah.
It now, teaches us solidarity too, right?
Yes.
Which is something, I mean, if the sociologists are right about talking about, you know, bowling alone, you know, like if there is a fragmentation going on and a kind of get behind the screens that we're carrying around instead of getting out with people, then the social movements have a responsibility to you teach us again the value of solidarity, and because we do need community in order to get the justice that we all deserve and want.
Absolutely. Now, you've talked about the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. Can you give us an example? You've spent six decades working for peace, civil rights, women's rights, labor, LGBTQ causes. Can you tell us, like, something that's personal, a moment where you felt you learned a lot about the potential for change?
Yes, I could tell about the our deciding a group of us, a living room group of us that's small enough to fit in a living room, right? Who decided to go after the seventh largest bank in the country and force it to give up a financially beneficial relationship that they had with the coal companies in Appalachia. What they were doing was they were the number one financer of blowing up mountains, of mountaintop removal coal mining.
Oh, my goodness.
Even though it was doubling the cancer rates in those areas and increasing birth defects and that kind of thing, and according to peer-reviewed journals, you know, I mean, they were literally killing people, as well as an incredible assault on the environment. And the bank was just smoothly, you know, moving ahead, making all this money. So we thought in our living room, a group of people, let's go after the bank. Well, to tell you the truth, Eleanor, there were some friends who heard about this later and said, George, now you've really lost it. So how are you going to do this? But the thing was, we grew from the living room to 13 states. We were able to do 125 direct actions, which involved disrupting bank operations over and over and over in bank branches. We shut down two shareholders' meetings, went inside and shut them down. We just did all these things in a highly nonviolent way. And we also did it in a spirit of a bit of a spirit of Merry Prankster, if you can picture that. You know what I mean?
Even though
the ideological background of the group was Quaker, Quakers, you know, is a religion that's kind of known for silent worship and so on, so we don't always think of Quakers as rapscallions, but because we had so many young people in the group, I think it was partly the youthful energy, and that some of the older ones of us, like I was 75 or something when we started, were also had some spirit of play. We were able to keep a lighthearted spirit going, even while we were hugely inconveniencing the bank and actually starting to ruin their brand. And most banks really care about their brand, and we were making their brand look really bad. $5 million was taken out of PNC by various depositors, put in community credit unions and that kind of thing. And what they could see after years of doing these actions was, all they could tell was we were growing, growing, growing. We were in more and more states where they operated. We were being more and more disruptive. They were having to close some of their bank branches, put signs in the window, locking out their customers and putting signs in the window saying, emergency closed. What was the emergency? The emergency was a couple dozen Quakers were going to come and sit in the middle of their floor. It's not exactly an emergency, but from their point of view, it was an emergency. So that was one of the most memorable things I've done in these six decades, was finding some kind of balance where we could, yes, we were targeting something that was grim. You know, I mean, it's a reality. What was going on in Appalachia was grim, but that we can carry a life-centered spirit that has room for lightness at the same time as we are obviously very committed and willing to go to jail over and over and over to make this thing right. And so I was very, very happy to say that we did win that campaign. And we decided, well, we like doing this, so let's do another campaign. Lots of new people came to join us because they liked the winner.
Right. That's wonderful. What a great story. And I think all social change starts in a living room somewhere. So good for you for doing that. Now, you mentioned some of the disruption in the bank processes and meetings as part of your campaign. And one of the things, a tactic being used sometimes now with Black Lives Matter and others, is disrupting traffic. What do you think of using that kind of a disruptive tactic now? Are you for it or against it?
Oh, I'm nearly always against it. I have done it in my life. I've done so many different things, and I have been arrested on a Friday afternoon rush hour, you know, closing a major, major street in the center of the city. And so I know what it's like. And looking back on it, in fact, we write about that in our book, How We Win. We have a wonderful chapter. Daniel Hunter, who's a brilliant, brilliant young tactician, was willing to respond to questions. So it's a co-written article on tactics. And one reason I'm against it is because it inconveniences the wrong people. It inconveniences the people who are trying to pick up their children from daycare. You know, it inconveniences people trying to get to a doctor. You know, it inconveniences people who are not the power holders. So I like disruption very much, as you could tell from my bank story, but I like disruption of the power holders. Like when you're in the shareholders meeting, you're sitting there with the one so-called 1%, you know, the economic elite. There you are sitting with them, well, disrupting their lives because they are making money out of killing people and attacking nature. I mean, that's just fine with me. So being more choosy about who you're disrupting and why is easily available, because the world of tactics is a huge world, and you can be very creative about tactics, and you can disrupt the lives of the people that you really want to disrupt instead of disrupting the people that you want to win over. And that's another thing that our book offers, is the new book, How We Win, is very much a support for people to figure out how can we win over allies so that our movement can grow? Because we know we're not going to win if we aren't growing. So how can we win over the people that we want to grow? And winning over folks by stopping them from picking up their children at childcare, well, come on.
Right. I totally agree with you on that. Well said. What about the tactic now that's become popular, at least here in Washington, D.C., of actually confronting some of these people, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders has been confronted when she's in a restaurant in D.C. People go in and go, you know, shame on you, that kind of thing. Do you support that kind of tactic? I mean, that is going for some of the power holders, but it also seems very in your face and aggressive and rude. I think that could turn people off. What do you think?
I can imagine some circumstances in which it would be effective, but I think right now, at any rate, where the movement is time-wise in our country, that's not a great idea. I think that time may come when everything becomes so sharply and clearly defined that somebody going to dinner will realize, okay, I'm going to dinner, but I'm actually is that I can understand why people are mainly seeing me in my role in the, you know, my role as part of the power structure instead of seeing me as somebody who's really tired and would love to just have some dinner. I could see that day may come, but I don't think that day is here yet. I think it's more important to target power holders in the places where they are in their role, in their oppressive role, in their role, engaging in behaviors that are really wrong, so that it's maximally clear. Because one of the big problems about growing a movement to be as large as it can be is how can our message be ever more clear about what we're about? And the fuzziness of going after people in restaurants as compared with the clarity of going after people in their offices when they're writing memos that support violence and oppression. See what I mean?
I totally agree with you. I think that's exactly right. And when you're talking about kind of growing the movement and doing it in a way that could appeal to more people to join in, I think at the core of it is the commitment to nonviolence. And it strikes me in reading your book, How We Win, that there's, of course, a very strong moral argument for nonviolence in the sense of respecting all life, even that of people who you vehemently disagree with, and even in the face of being a target of violence yourself, but that there's a deep commitment to nonviolence. But not only is it morally the right thing to do, you talk in your book about a study of the 20th century movements that shows the movements which are nonviolent are twice as successful as those that are violent. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of nonviolence in the direct action campaigns?
Yes, yes. You're quite right. That book, The Logic of Civilian Resistance, is a stunning, isn't it, study by political scientists. By the way, the senior one of whom, or the one whose name is first on the cover, Erica Chenoweth, comes from a background of kind of the hard-boiled wing of political scientists, if I could say that. I might get in trouble at Swarthmore College referring to political scientists as hard-boiled, but I think some of them are. And she had that background of being very, very skeptical about nonviolence. And yet the statistical study that they did showed no question that twice as effective were the nonviolent ones as compared with the violent ones. Well, one reason, there are multiple reasons for that. One reason is that the clarity that is supported by nonviolence, where it's violence always confuses things, but nonviolence is more likely to support the clarity of the message of the movement, is more likely to win over people who are in the opposition. Now, there are particular people you especially want to win over. You want, for example, police, and if you're in the kind of situation some people are where it's the army that's against you, too, you know, like, like many of the campaigns that have happened have been up against the army as well as having to deal with police. You want those people who are being instructed by their superiors to be violent toward you, you want them to be as inefficient as possible. Right?
Right. And sometimes deliberately so.
Maybe they're being ordered to shoot you down, but you want them to not quite be able to get their rifle down quite low enough to be able to actually shoot you, and they're shooting over your head, right?
Right.
All that kind of thing. Well, you're far more likely. In other words, it's way safer for you to offer nonviolent resistance because you're more likely to get that kind of inefficiency going on. And in some struggles that we've documented, troops have actually refused to shoot when ordered to shoot.
Right.
And police have refused to shoot or refused to arrest when ordered to do so because the nonviolence makes the message clearer. And they can see, oh my gosh, why should I shoot these people when I'm actually in agreement with them?
Right. That's right. Now, you've been in situations yourself where you've been engaged in a nonviolent direct action and been confronted with some violence. You know, we saw it in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, where the armed right-wing extremists are out there and they're threatening people. What do you recommend to people? Like, you're out there and you're for human rights, you know, on the right side of things, and you're faced with a right-wing extremist who's got a gun and ready to shoot, or a car and ready to mow you down. How do we respond to that, and how did you respond to that when you were in threatening moments like that?
Right. Well, of course, there are no guarantees for whatever you do, right? It's all working with probabilities. But I'm confident that the probability goes with a nonviolent response. And so, for example, when a very irate soldier, right-wing soldier who was very defensive, you know, on behalf of the Vietnam War, and he was on furlough, and I ran into him because I was downtown in a street meeting, and I got off the soapbox where I'd been preaching against the Vietnam War, not preaching, but, you know, speaking against the Vietnam War. And he was standing there in the crowd getting more and more and more upset with me. And so I joined the crowd. Somebody else was on the box. And he came over to me, pulled out a knife, and he was going to do me in.
Oh.
So I could understand why he'd feel that way, right? Because he'd probably lost buddies in the war, you know, and so on and so on. And here was this guy being, from his point of view, I was being unpatriotic and not respecting soldiers and so on. So that's what he did. So he pulled out this knife. But the crowd was all around us in such a way that nobody else could witness it. You know, he was being secretive, but there was the knife. So I looked at him in the eyes very strongly and without fear. Later, I felt very, very terrified. But at that moment, I was able to summon my courage and look him in the eye and said, if you do this, you might be sorry later. Think about the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And he stared back for a minute and then put the knife away.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So sometimes speaking very directly, you know, eyeball to eyeball to somebody when they're about to do violence, you can really talk them out of it. Other times, I've been like flat on my, you know, on my belly, jumped by young guys, sort of young men who were very upset with the demonstration I was part of, and they caught me on the way to the train, you know, in a kind of back lot, kind of, or, you know, in a somewhat obscure place. They were able to catch up with me, and they threw me on the ground, and they jumped on me. And that's when I remembered the training, because there's a lot of nonviolence training that helps us to become more effective nonviolent actors. And so I remembered that the training is all about be as limp as you can be, like be as relaxed as you can be. Not only are you less likely to sustain injury, but you're also signaling something to them. And so I did that. So even though they were all yelling at the same time, so there wasn't much I could say, but I could at least start praying, which was helpful to my body in terms of relaxation, and went into that relaxed place. And they unpeeled themselves and let me go.
Wow.
Whereas so, I know that if I had, even though I'm a big guy, actually, I'm 6'4" and a big guy, but I know if I had resisted, they were about seven guys, and I would have gotten thoroughly trashed. So I've had experiences like that have confirmed to me the value of nonviolence in those situations where we're being attacked.
That's very powerful. What a testimony to the impact that nonviolence can have. That's really great. You've talked earlier about the different historic case studies we've got now of nonviolent direct action from the women's right to vote and the civil rights movement and the gay rights movement. And you mentioned that there's a database on these nonviolent direct action experiences at Swarthmore. You mentioned in the book, too, that there's an actual global database of nonviolent action. Can you talk about, where can people go to learn more about the case studies of nonviolent campaigns?
Oh, yeah, I'm so happy to say we were able to put it online. We were able to put it online maybe 4 years ago or so, and so everybody can get it as close as your computer is. It's just called, I Google it. When I look for it, I just Google Global Nonviolent Action Database. Global Nonviolent Action Database, and it comes right up. And so it's a searchable database. So, for example, if you want to read about cases in your state or your city or your country, you can do that. If you're interested in, for example, human rights, you can search for human rights cases. You can search for environmental cases if that's your particular interest. You can search for the community level ones or the big sort of national ones. There's just lots of searching potential there. Over 1,100 cases we have now from almost 200 countries. We have more cases from the civil rights movement than anybody. I mean, Alice Paul is in there, you can be sure, and a whole bunch of other women's struggles. Mm-hmm. So it's an inspiring kind of thing. And you can also look for the cases where people have had the hardest time in terms of repression from authorities, and see, what did they do? How were they able to persevere? And so on. And we have cases where people lost. So this is not a selective database in which we only have winning campaigns on there. Mm-hmm. We also have losing campaigns. And we've had the researchers score every single campaign in terms on a score of 1 to 10 in terms of how well they did. And so if you're particularly interested in, well, what were the awesome winners good at? But you could also say, well, let's learn from the losers. Let's find out what they did wrong. And so you can search for those. So it just gives you so many. And then on the question of tactics, we were talking about tactics earlier. If you're in a kind of group or know of a group that seems to be in a stuck place where all they do is marches and rallies, and it's getting so boring, there are 200 different methods of nonviolent struggle that are documented on this database. So if you're interested in, straying outside the actions and finding out what others have done that was really, really dazzling and creative, you can find that stuff on the database, too. It's just Global Nonviolent Database.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I love that you've helped put that together there. And the Global Nonviolent Action Database, what a great idea. And as you were talking, I was thinking, wouldn't it be fun if we had like an annual Academy Award for Nonviolent Direct Action.
I would love that.
That would be really fun. There's so many to choose from, and you know, we need different things to draw attention to these great efforts at social change, so vital today. You know, in the challenging times we live in, and also, you know, we do face this issue where you don't hear about these nonviolent direct action campaigns much on the TV. I mean, you get the picture of a big march, so that gets some media attention. But we're in a time where a lot of the journalists are being put out of work. A lot of the newspapers are shutting down. How do you recommend that people who are engaged in the struggles for women's rights, gay rights, greater wealth equality, how do we deal with this? How do we get attention to the campaigns that we're engaged in?
Right. It can be very difficult, especially for those of us who got used to there being a lot of journalism, journalistic
right.
attention, and then we think, oh my gosh, we're not getting that anymore, so maybe it's really tough. So that's where, though, we can put our strategy hats on and become ever more clever about figuring out, well, what is our target, that is the decider, what are their points of vulnerability, and really do a careful analysis of that. For example, on that bank campaign that I referred to, we figured out that we would get very little journalistic coverage for our campaign, and therefore we had to find points of vulnerability that were other than that. And so we found out, well, okay, so one of them is that they are out on college campuses recruiting in September for the first-year students. They're recruiting them as customers. So they really want those young people to, away from home, taking care of money, join our bank, because then maybe they can keep them as lifelong customers, right? So that's important to the bank. Well, that's important to us, too. So then we started going to the campuses in that first week of orientation and go to the place where there were tables of different kinds, including the table that run by the bank. Hey, young person, check us out. So we would just stand next to the table and tell the young students who were coming over what the bank was actually doing in Appalachia.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa. So that would be an example of the many points of vulnerability that we discovered on their parts. And so they finally gave in because we were going after those things. So it just depends then on the opponent or decider and figuring out what are the things that they would really hate for us to do, and let's do those things. And if we get publicity along with it, if we're covered in the media, that's great, but we don't need to be covered by the media in order to be able to reach them.
Very good, and particularly now we've got social media to connect with people that's free and can cover a lot of territory. I'm wondering, we've talked about the different issues out there that we're concerned about, women, gays, we got labor, LBG, the whole democracy movement itself now. How do we get beyond this fragmentation to move to what you call a movement of movements, where instead of kind of being so fractured and independent, that there's actually some way that this synergy, that there's mutual support among all the different issue groups working for their issue?
Oh, that's so important, because we can't change the whole country just on the basis of a particular issue, right? We need connection big time in order to achieve the mass scale that's necessary to move the country forward. And so I really think that's a very important question. I looked into that question while I was researching the book Viking Economics, my previous book, mm-hmm. because I was very curious, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, how did they managed to turn themselves around. They were such a wreck 100 years ago, and now, of course, they're at the top of the line in many, many metrics that have to do with justice and prosperity and shared prosperity, equality, and so on. And I was so curious about how did their movements pull together, because they all had farmers' movements, but the farmers wouldn't talk to the workers. The industrial workers' movements, labor unions, but they wouldn't talk to the farmers because farmers are yokels and so on. And then there were middle-class people who cared about getting a better country, but they tended to look down on the workers and on the farmers. So it was, and then geographical diffusion in Norway, especially all these little valleys and mountains in between and stuff like that. So it was kind of a mess trying to get everything together. What worked for them, and I think would work for us, was to develop a vision that showed what we could achieve if we worked together, what kind of country we could have, and specifically how it would benefit the farmers. And how it would benefit the workers, and how it would benefit the middle class. So they showed, you know, in concrete terms, we would be able to do this. We would be able to, for example, have free higher education for everybody, which came to pass. We could have free medical care, health care for everybody. We could have pensions for everybody. As you know, here in the U.S., we're headed toward a real pension crisis, but they have no pension crisis because they took care of, there's pensions for everybody. They said no older person should ever be poor in our country. So they developed a vision of all these changes that otherwise people felt a little bit on their own trying to get. And then that made the unity possible. Because then everybody could say, the farmers could say, oh, well, we notice our opposition is also the same as the opposition as the workers are getting. But here's a vision of when we overcome that opposition, we can have the country that's going to benefit the farmers and the workers and these middle-class people.
That's fantastic, and that's all the time we have. The book is How We Win. George Lakey, thank you so much for being with us on All Together Now.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been fun.